from Shaitan, the rebellious one who has been cast away from the kingdom of God's extra mercy. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I begin this talk of mine seeking the assistance of Allah, who is the absolute perfect being, to whom belong all the excellent and perfect qualities, principal amongst which are that He is Rahman, meaning that His rahmah and love and mercy reach out to each and every particle in the universe for every moment of its existence. And that He is Rahim, meaning that His extra love and mercy is directed specifically to those amongst us who believe in Him and who follow His guidance. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. All our praise belongs only to Allah, because He is the all-perfect being, because all perfection and beauty and goodness that we see in the universe all flows from Him. And because He is the master and the cherisher and the nourisher and the maintainer of the whole universe. والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين And our choicest salutations and greetings on the last prophet of God, who was the most humblest of all the servants of God and managed to reach the highest state of perfection possible for any human being, whereby he then received the final and the most comprehensive plan of God for mankind's success. And our salutations and greetings on his holy progeny. Scholars of Islam, elders and brethren in Islam, Salamun Alaikum. We're living the moments of the spiritual month of Ramadan, and God in His wisdom has legislated and made it compulsory on us to fast. And the main purpose is so that we can achieve taqwa and that level of God consciousness which permeates all the aspects of our lives. We were discussing about the effects of God consciousness, and we said that even the consorts and the wives of the Prophet, if they are to be respected by us and if they are to be considered by us to be the mothers of the believers, it's only because they do not get attracted to the passing pleasures of the world that they seek to please Allah and the Prophet, and they seek the next world, and the fact that their whole personality revolves around taqwa. Ya Nisa An-Nabi, Lastunna ka ahadin minan nisa in attaqaytunna. All the wives of the Prophet, you are not like the other ordinary women if you have taqwa. We stop discussion on ayah number 33 of Surah Ahzab, chapter 33. Ayah number 34 mentions one other feature of these mothers of the believers. God tells them, وَذْكُرْنَ مَا يُتْلَى فِي بُيُوتِكُنَّ مِنْ آيَاتِ اللَّهِ وَالْحِكْمَةِ. And all the wives of the Prophet, recall those signs of God which are being recited in your homes. Whenever a revelation came to the Prophet, he would repeat and recite for everyone, including his wives. Because his wives were the closest to him physically, obviously they heard more, and because they were close to the mosque, they heard it frequently. The ayah tells them, remember and recall and recite the signs of God, the verses of God as they are revealed to the Prophet, and also the wisdom and the higher truths of life, that life is not only a physical existence, that there are realities beyond this physical life. Recall them, remember them, recite them, relate to the others. Wa kana Allah, inna Allah kana latifan khabira. Remember that God is Latif. He's got lutf. He's got love and mercy which is penetrating. Or Latif meaning that He penetrates right into the deep mysteries of every human being. Khabira, he's all-knowing. One of the features of these God-conscious women that Allah wants us to emulate and imitate and follow is interpersonal relationships as far as the two sexes are concerned. In ayah number 59, God says, Ya ayyuhan nabi, O Prophet, قل لأزواجك, tell your wives, وبناتك, and your daughters, ونساء المؤمنين, and the women of the believers, tell them, يدنين عليهن من جلابيبهن. This outward dress that they wear, let them cover their bodies with them properly. And why should they do that? Two reasons. ذلك أدنى أن يعرفنا. That's the minimum requirement so that their identity is made clear to the people. Hijab is the means of the identity of a Muslim woman, first of all. And second of all, ذلك أدنى أن يعرفنا فلا يؤذين. So that they will not suffer any molestation and any harassment. وَكَانَ اللَّهُ غَفُورًا رَحِيمًا. Indeed, God is forgiving if you have made mistakes in the past. He is merciful. He will help you to improve in the future. I wish to pause here and expand on this concept of hijab being a means of identity, first of all, and being a means of protection against harassment, secondly. We're living in an age when multiple studies and reports and surveys have been conducted to show what is sexual harassment as happens in the advanced Western societies. But before I tell you the findings of these reports, let's define and understand what sexual harassment is. Any sexual advance, any request made for a sexual favor, which is unsolicited, which is imposed upon a woman, either physically or verbally, and especially so if the conduct of that woman sexually will determine whether she will be successful in her work or in the educational institution, or whether if after she gets admitted to the work or after she gets admitted to the educational institution, whether she can maintain and keep her work, or whether she can achieve anything educationally. If her sexual conduct determines these things and she's being forced to behave that way, that is sexual harassment. That means if in the workplace the supervisor or the boss comes and physically touches her parts of the body, whether it's her neck or her waist or her arms or pinches her bottom, that's sexual harassment. Verbally, if somebody comes and makes sexual jokes against her, if she is told that as a woman she has got inferior capabilities, if because she has different moods she's told she's suffering her monthly periods, or she's being referred to as a girl, or the supervisor says, I like my girls to wear skirts. This is verbal sexual harassment. So if a woman applies to become a secretary and there is the boss who has to judge in her probation period whether she should then be given permanent employment or not, and the boss then asks for a sexual favor, that's sexual harassment. If a supervisor likes to sneak up behind the female employees and pinch their bottoms or embrace them against the wishes of the women, that's sexual harassment. If the colleagues in the workplace or anywhere else like to make sexual jokes, that's sexual harassment. Having understood what the definition is, it's amazing the degree to which it's prevalent. Studies began to be done in the late 70s onwards about the prevalence and the widespread occurrence of sexual harassment in the workplace, in the educational institutions. The findings are surprising. Claire Saffron, she's written a report, What Men Do to Women, the shocking look at sexual harassment. She reports 90% of female employees report being sexually harassed. They may not disclose it publicly, but when they are asked privately, they do admit. The university, Cornell University, conducted surveys and they found that 90% of the female students considered sexual harassment as a serious problem. 70% said yes, they experienced it. The United States federal government, 23,000 employees were interviewed. 42% said that they suffered sexual harassment in their workplace. Of these, 29% said they suffered severe sexual harassment, meaning that they were being touched, meaning that on their dates they were being forced to have sexual acts. 12% reported minor, lesser degrees of sexual harassment, meaning that there were harassing telephone calls being made to them, meaning that some leering sexual looks were being made upon them, meaning that they were being forced to come out for a date. Sexual harassment is a phenomena that is widespread. If you just look at the internet under sexual harassment, I didn't have the time to look at the multiple hits that you get. But one thing stands out clearly. It's a billions-dollar industry right now for lawyers because women are filing complaints about being victimized by sexual harassment. Look at the effects of sexual harassment on women. According to one study, more than 3/4 of these women, they feel angry at what's happening to them. Almost half of them, they're agitated. Almost 1/4 of them, they're afraid. Almost more than 1/4 of them, they feel depressed, they feel deserted, they feel isolated, they feel lonely. But the problem is here now. What do? How do they react? The majority of them know that if they raise a complaint, nobody's going to bother about them. They don't have evidence. They know that they will face retaliation. They will face reprisals. They will be labeled as troublemakers. You see, these women are looking just for a workplace where they can work peacefully and productively and their performance should not be affected. So the advice given to them, most of them, they just cope with these sexual harassments. They just cope with it with an air of indifference. Charles Zastrow and Karen Kirst Ashman, in their book on understanding human behavior, they say most of these women, they change their behavior. What they do now is they wear less revealing clothes. These women, they start wearing less sexually provocative clothes. Look at what the ayah in the Quran said. O Prophet, tell your wives, one, tell the daughters and tell the believing women that they should dress well and in modesty, so that their identity is clear, one, so that they do not become victims of sexual harassment, two. Zastrow and Ashman continue. They say the advice we give to such women is A, try to be assertive. That means whoever is your victimizer, whoever is your harasser, just go and confront them, stand up to them, don't smile, be serious, convey the message very clearly. I don't like this behavior of you touching my neck or my arm or my waist or my bottom. Be assertive. Look at what the hijab ayah says. Your identity should be clear. Who are you? Why do people wear clothes? What purpose do clothes serve? Number one, basically it's damage protection. So suppose you're living in a very hot summer condition. The Arabs have developed this white dress which is free-flowing, so air flows and it absorbs the perspiration. If you go to winter climates, you need warm woolen clothing. All right, if you go, you're an exceptional astronaut, you need some extra protection against temperatures. Different conditions need protection. Damage protection is one. But there's a second purpose of clothing. By the type of dress, you make a declaration of who you are. One, of what you like to be, two, of what your feelings are, three, and of what your future plans are, four. Clothes speak. Clothes declare who you are. Good enough, we know very few people from their faces on an international level. Those who are famous government officials or sports officials or whatever. But the majority of the people can be recognized by their dress. Who are they? What is their occupation? A nurse has got a particular dress, a doctor, a police officer. All occupations have particular dress. It tells us who this person is as far as the occupation and the age and the sex will be concerned. Secondly, it tells us what sort of an outlook this person has. There are some people who like to wear flashy clothes. Some people wear plain clothes. In the United States, there's a community known as the Amish community. There, the men wear dark and plain clothes. The women wear long and plain clothes. That's a statement they're making. We're not concerned with the other affairs of life. Clothes are not a priority for us. There are other matters which are more serious. It's a statement being made. Some people express their feelings through their clothes. When you're happy, you wear white. Of course, it's a cultural matter. In the United States, in the West, most of the people, women, when they get married, they wear white. In India, when a person dies, the woman wears white. But you express your feelings. You express what you want to become by your clothes. When you go for an interview in a job application, you try to wear your best clothes. You're projecting yourself. If clothes speak our personality, then hijab gives a clear message to the potential harasser that I'm a person who's modest, I've got limits, and I'm serious. I'm not here for hanky-panky. You see, unfortunately, the culture we're living in, it's being bombarded on the males that they can have fun with the females. You start right from when they're kids. Georgie Porgie, pudding and pie. Kiss the girls and made them cry. When the boys came out to play, Georgie Porgie ran away. Look at the message that's being given about the relationship between boys and girls. The fact that girls, they're supposed to be soft and sweet. And then there's this one person who can be the harasser, Georgie Porgie. And this harasser will harass sexually. He will go and kiss. And then the girls will do nothing. They will just cry. And they cannot defend themselves. The good ones have to come, the boys. And then this bad boy will run away. But why can't a woman stand up for herself and say, who is she? Georgie Porgie, pudding and pie. Kiss the girls and make them cry. Why not say, when the girls combine to play, Georgie Porgie runs away. You express yourself by your hijab. And you protect yourself against sexual harassment. I would like to quote certain statements being made by American women, women born in the United States, who then convert to Islam. There's a book by the name of Daughters of Another Path. It's written by Carol Anway. Carol Anway has got a master's in education and in the field of guidance and counseling. She's a student counselor. And she's made several workshops throughout the United States and Canada. Her daughter, Jody, she got married to an Iranian, Reza Mohammadzadeh. So now her daughter is Jody Anway Mohammadzadeh. She lost the daughter in one sense. She was raised up as a Christian, but then she became a Muslim. That was 14 years ago. The book was published in 1996, so it's about 16 years ago. Anway got interested to find out what are the opinions and the lifestyles and the beliefs of the American-born Muslim converts. And she conducted a survey, handed out. Women had bachelor degrees in their education. 12% had masters. 6% had doctorates, either in medicine or philosophy, of doctor of philosophy. These were educated, intelligent, American-born Muslim converts. I'd like to quote a few statements that they made in response to those questionnaires. On page number 74, one of the Muslim American-born women says, "Wearing hijab, it was easy." Because they were asked, "What happened after you became a Muslim? How did you practice Islam in America?" "Wearing hijab was easy. But people were always asking me if I had some sort of a disease. They thought maybe I was bald and therefore I was trying to cover my head with the scarf. Then after I explained to them about the religious reasons and the significance of wearing hijab, they would say, 'You mean I can never see your beautiful hair again?' And this woman would say, 'It seems that these people expected me to give them the privilege, no, to give them the pleasure of enjoying my beauty, despite the fact that I had made a personal choice in my life that I'm going to lead a particular lifestyle.'" This woman says, "The people missed the point." Look at this other woman. She says, "The best Islamic right by far is the hijab. I have a right to be looked at as a moral woman, not a piece of meat, which is to be gawked and ogled at. People look at my eyes when they talk to me, and I'm treated like a lady, not like a piece of meat to be enjoyed, not like a sexual object." On page number 161, there are further quotations. When these women were asked, "Tell us, what would you like to tell the American public about yourselves?" Some of them said, "I would like the American public to know that we are people just like them. We're not terrorists, we're not fundamentalists, we're not oppressed by these Middle Eastern husbands of ours. We struggle to pay bills. We worry about tomorrow. We want peace. My husband did not make me dress this way. I'm not oppressed. I am free." Now look at the statement. "I am free in my hijab. I'm free from the bondage of fashion, from the bondage of clothes, from the bondage of hair, from the bondage of shoes, and the like. Inheritance is guaranteed for me and for my children after the payment of debts." Look at yet another saying of an American woman. "I don't like to be ridiculed," she says, "because of my dress. I feel sad when someone comes and mocks at me because of the clothing I wear. Would you mock a Christian nun because of the dress she wears? Would you mock an Amish woman because of the dress she wears? Would you mock at a Mennonite woman because of the bonnet she wears? Why don't you respect me for who I am?" Yet another woman, "I'm not oppressed. It is not degrading for me to wear proper clothing. I'd like the American public to know that my husband does the laundry at home. He even helps with the cleaning." In brackets, she wrote, "He even cleans the toilet bowl. And he helps look after the children so that I go out. I'm not oppressed as a Muslim woman." Yet another woman says, "Don't judge me by the few Muslims who do un-Islamic behavior. Get to know me. Find out who am I. Talk to me. Invite me to your schools, to your churches. I'll explain to you what I am and what my religion is. Don't ask us about from books written by the so-called Middle Eastern experts. Don't think I'm repressed by my clothes." And this is wonderful what this woman has said. "When you look at me, you should remember how Abraham's wife looked. When you look at me, you should remember how Jesus' mother looked. When you look at me, remember it's part of your heritage, the American Judeo-Christian people. I'm not different." And yet another woman says, "Just because I cover my head does not make me a weirdo, a fundamentalist, a suppressed woman, a weak woman. And I hate it such that everywhere I go, people just stare at me as if I'm somebody abnormal. I'm a normal person who has made a choice of my lifestyle, and I wish to be respected." In conclusion, If God in His wisdom has legislated that the wives of the Prophet and the daughters of the Prophet and the women of the believers should observe hijab, two reasons have been mentioned, at least in this ayah. There are other reasons elsewhere. One is the Muslim woman shows her identity, who she is, a serious person, a person with a vision, a person with a goal, a person who's following a particular lifestyle. She expects respect, not degradation. And secondly, she makes a very clear statement to those potential sexual harassers that she's not available to be treated like a sexual object or a piece of meat. Let's pray to Allah to give us the tawfiq to be able to appreciate the deeper meanings and reasons behind the all-wise legislation. And let's also have the tawfiq to be able to implement these wise teachings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. From Shaitan, the rebellious one who has been cast away from God's kingdom of extra mercy. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I seek the assistance of Allah before I start my talk, because He is the absolute perfect being. To Him belong all the excellent attributes and qualities, principal amongst which are that He is Rahman, meaning that His rahmah and His love and mercy reach out to each and every particle in the universe for every moment of its existence. And that He is Rahim, meaning that His extra rahmah and love and mercy are directed specifically to those amongst us who believe in Him and who follow His guidance. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. All praise belongs to Him and Him alone, because He's the All Perfect One, and therefore all perfection and all beauty and all goodness that we see in the universe, from any actor of goodness to any recipient of goodness, all stems from Him. And because He's the master and the cherisher and the provider and the maintainer of the whole universe. As-salatu was-salamu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina Muhammadin wa alihi at-tahirin. In our choicest salutations and greetings on the last prophet from God, the one who was the most humblest of all servants before God, and therefore the one who managed to reach the highest spiritual status possible for any human being, a status at which he then could receive the most comprehensive and final plan of God for mankind. And our salutations also on his holy progeny, scholars of Islam, elders in Islam, brethren in Islam. Salamun alaykum. We're living the precious moments where God's special favors and mercies are available for us in this holy month of Ramadan. And in order to enable us to maximally receive these special favors, God, out of His love, has asked us to fast. And through the process of fasting, we achieve the level of taqwa. And taqwa has many manifestations in a Muslim's life. We were discussing some of these manifestations as portrayed in the lives of the wives of the Prophet. And we said the special status accorded to them, as is accorded to anyone in a leadership position, is because of their taqwa. Ya Nisa An-Nabi Lastunna Ka Ahadin Min An-Nisa In ittaqaytunna. O the women of the Prophet, you are not like any ordinary woman, provided you have taqwa. And that requires these women, فَلَا تَخْضَعْنَا بِالْقَوْلِ. Whenever you talk to the opposite sex, be very careful how you talk and what you talk. فَلَا تَخْضَعْنَا بِالْقَوْلِ فَيَطْمَعَ الَّذِي فِي قَلْبِهِ مَرَضٌ. Because you will come across people, men, who are sick in their hearts, and they would behave negatively toward these women. وَقُلْنَا قَوْلًا مَعْرُوفًا. And whatever you speak should be positive. Notice the ayah that we were discussing, Surah Ahzab, chapter 33, ayah number 59. The address and the call is out to the women of the believers. يا أيها النبي قل لأزواجك وبناتك ونساء المؤمنين. O Prophet, tell your wives and tell your daughters and tell the women of the believing people, the believers, that they should observe hijab, and that there are two advantages. It gives them, it declares their identity, and secondly, it protects them from molestation and from sexual harassment. Before I discuss this a little further, I want to pause here. Notice, the status that is accorded to the wives of the Prophet is because of their belief and therefore their taqwa. The address of hijab is to those women who are believers. Let me just elaborate a little on this concept of belief because it's very important. In the Quran, we are told that we must differentiate between the outward expression of belief and actual belief. Surah Al-Hujurat, chapter 49, ayah number 14, God says, وَقَالَتِ الْأَعْرَابُ آمَنَّا. You'll find these Bedouin Arabs, you see, when Islam was established all over Arabia, many tribes who were not in the cities, who were nomads in the desert, they came and surrendered to the authority of the Prophet and Islam. They outwardly professed Islam, but actually they were not believers. وَقَالَتِ الْأَعْرَابُ آمَنَّا. The Arab Bedouins will come and tell you, we believe. قُلْ لَمْ تُؤْمِنُوا. O Prophet, let me inform you the actual status of these people's hearts. You don't know. If you look at them, apparently they look like believers. قُلْ لَمْ تُؤْمِنُوا. Tell them you are not true believers as yet. وَلَمَّا يَدْخُلِ الْإِيمَانُ فِي قُلُوبِكُمْ. The fact of the matter is that faith and belief has not yet settled and entered your hearts. Faith has several stages. Marhum Imam Khomeini, may Allah raise his status, in his dars which he used to give in akhlaq, and in the writings of his akhlaq, he warns us, he tells us, be careful. There's a difference between knowing something and believing in something. We may be born in Muslim families, therefore we may know there is a God, and we may know there are prophets, and we may know there are imams, and we may know there is a qiyamah. But that does not make us believers. Why? You may come across people who are experts, the so-called Middle Eastern experts. They know more about Islam than we do. But they're not believers. He may be from a Jewish background, from a Christian background, from a Hindu background. Knowledge of Islam doesn't make a person a believer, first of all. Secondly, observe the case of Shaitan. He knew a lot of things, yet God did not accept him to be a believer. When he was expelled for his rebellion and rejection and refusal to bow down and prostrate before Adam for the sake of God, and when he was asked, why did you refuse? Look at his response. He said, خَلَقْتَنِي مِن نَارٍ وَخَلَقْتَهُ مِن طِينٍ. Because you, God, created me. Therefore you are the creator, I am the created one, from fire. You created him from clay. You are the creator, he is the created, but he is created from clay. Shaitan knew God was the creator. And then when he was about to be punished, he asked for forgiveness for respite. قَالَ أَنْذِرْنِي إِلَىٰ يَوْمِ يُبْعَثُونَ. Give me respite up until the day when you will resurrect. Shaitan knew that in the future there is going to be a time of resurrection. And then when he declares, because you expelled me, I swear by your majesty, فَبِعِزَّتِكَ لَأُغْوِيَنَّهُمْ أَجْمَعِينَ. I will most surely, definitely mislead all of them, the sons of Adam. إِلَّا. He himself makes an exception. إِلَّا عِبَادَكَ مِنْهُمُ الْمُخْلَصِينَ. There are some of these servants, I cannot touch them. They're just too high for them. Despite all my efforts to reach up till them, I will not be able to reach them. They're so high, they're so pure in their thoughts, they're so much in control of their hearts and minds, The moment I even knock the door, they know it's me. And they don't open the door of their hearts. I can't touch them. Shaitan knew that they were going to be prophets. And they were going to be people who are pure. And they're going to be followers of these prophets. Despite his knowledge of God being the creator, despite his knowledge of there being a day of resurrection, despite his knowledge of all prophets, God declares him to be a disbeliever. Aba wastakbara wa kana min al kafirin. He was a disbeliever. Marhum Imam Khomeini says, notice, to know something is not to believe in something. Take a more practical example, he says. When you come across a person who has died, and he's dead and therefore motionless, try to spend one dark, empty night with that dead person. How many of us have the courage to do that? How many of us would start getting afraid? Somehow, maybe this motionless person would open his arms and then come and embrace us in a deathly embrace. Our minds know, logically, a dead person is motionless. Our hearts haven't accepted it as yet. And therefore, if the address in the ayah for hijab, both for males and for females, is to the believers, we need to appreciate what is belief. Belief basically is a state of the heart. Islam expects us not to believe in anything unless we are logically convinced. A. We're not to reject anything unless we have evidence to say that this is false. B. Our sixth holy Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, salamullahu alayhi. He says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ عَيَّرَ فِي كِتَابِهِ. God has condemned two categories of people. الَّذِينَ أَنْ لَا يَقْبَلُوا مَا لَمْ يَعْلَمُوا. If they don't know anything, they should not accept it. And if they don't have evidence, they should not reject it. In Surah A'raf, chapter 7, ayah number 169, Allah says, أَلَمْ يُؤْخَذَ عَلَيْهِمْ مِيثَاقُ الْكِتَابِ أَنْ لَا يَقُولُوا عَلَى اللَّهِ إِلَّا الْحَقِّ. Have we not taken a covenant with these people and a contract which they have to accept and which they accepted? They should never speak against God unless what they know to be true. If you believe in something, you must be convinced it's true. Take the opposite. Surah Yunus, ayah number 39. God says, بَلْ كَذَّبُوا بِمَا لَمْ يُحِيطُوا بِعِلْمِهِ. They rejected that which they did not know. If we reject something and say we don't believe in these things, we must have proof for it. So step number one, logically, our mind has to accept the basic articles of belief. Step number two, then these articles which have been logically accepted have to be transferred to our heart. The process of transferring to the heart is that we learn to talk to our hearts. Imam Khomeini quotes his ustad, Ayatollah Marhum Shah Abadi. He says, consider your heart to be a small child. You notice when a baby first starts to speak, it cannot speak well. You have to teach it. Say, ba, ba, ma, ma, pencil, pen, whatever. Whatever word that you're teaching. You have to repeat once, twice, thrice, four times, repetitively. The child slowly listens, hears, and then repeats back. The joy and the accomplishment is when the child learns to speak on its own. So also Imam Khomeini tells us, constantly remind the heart, that child within, it has to be taught. Whatever you have logically accepted to be true, constantly remind the child. Till you reach such a state that you don't no longer need to tell the child. The child within speaks by itself. And that's when the belief settles in. And that's when the effect comes out. Surah Anfal, chapter 8, ayah number 3, onwards. إِنَّمَا الْمُؤْمِنُونَ الَّذِينَ إِذَا ذُكِرَ اللَّهُ وَجِلَتْ قُلُوبُهُمْ. The true believers are those who whenever God is recalled, they tremble. The effect is already there. وَإِذَا تُلِيَتْ عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتُهُ. When the signs of God are recited unto them, زادتهم إيمانا. Their iman becomes stronger. It's already there, it becomes stronger. Contrast this effect to that in Surah Luqman, chapter 31, ayah number 6. There are those who listen to vain talks, for example music, for example novels, for example movies. In contrast, إِذَا تُلِيَتْ عَلَيْهِ آيَاتُنَا وَلَّا مُسْتَكْبِرًا. When the signs of God are recited to such people, they turn their face away in arrogance. كَأَنْ لَمْ يَسْمَعَهَا. He behaves, when he listens to the word of God, as if he never heard the word of God. He ignores it. Not only that, كَأَنَّ فِي أُذُنَيْهِ وَقْرًا. As if there is heaviness in his ears. God never creates anyone with heaviness in his spiritual ears. Whenever we are born with clean hearts. We are already ready to accept the true message. But because of our sins, because of the negative thoughts, because of the negative feelings, we can kill our hearts and reach a state when our hearts become deaf. So a believer is one. Whenever when God is recalled before him, he trembles. Secondly, when the signs of God are recited to him, his faith is strengthened. وَعَلَىٰ رَبِّهِمْ يَتَوَكَّلُونَ. Their reliance on God is great. Why? Because they know God is all-knowing. Whatever problems I have, God knows. Whatever work I want to do, God has the power to help me. Second, not only that, He's all-loving. He'll never abandon me. If that's the case, why should I rely on anyone else other than God? وَعَلَىٰ رَبِّهِمْ يَتَوَكَّلُونَ. الَّذِينَ يُقِيمُونَ الصَّلَاةِ. They're in constant contact with God. وَمِمَّا رَزَقْنَاهُمْ يُنْفِقُونَ. Whatever we grant them of our gifts, whether it's time we give them, whether it's talents we give them, whether it's treasures we give them, their wealth, their gifts, and their talents, and their potentials, they spend, they share with others. And finally the ayah says, أُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ حَقًّا. These are the true believers. لَهُمْ دَرَجَاتٌ عِنْدَ رَبِّهِمْ. They have different stages and status before God, depending to the extent that they tremble, and to the extent that their faith is strengthened, and to the extent that they rely on God, and to the extent that their constant remembrance of God, and to the extent that they share whatever God has given them. And مَغْفِرَةٌ وَرِزْقٌ كَرِيمٌ. And for them is a generous provision. Having said that, and having understood what a true believer is, let's return back to the ayah we were discussing about hijab. Ya ayyuhan nabi, Surah Ahzab chapter 33, ayah number 59. Qul li azwajika wa banatika wa nisa'il mu'minin. Tell the women of the believers, believing women. Yudnina alayhinna min jalabibihinna. They should wear proper hijab. ذَلِكَ أَدْنَىٰ أَن يُعْرَفْنَا. That is the minimum for them to be recognized and their identity to be declared. فَلَا يُؤْذَيْنَا. So that they will not suffer sexual harassment. There is one step which is the extreme form of sexual harassment. And I wish to discuss that because that is also directly related to hijab. And that is rape. Rape is the ultimate form of sexual harassment. It's the sexual assault. It's basically a sexual aggressive act against a woman. When you force sex upon a woman, that's rape. Let's consider first of all how widespread is the incidence of rape. Secondly, what effects does it have on the victims? And thirdly, why does it occur? And how is it related to hijab? As far as the incidence is concerned, William Masters and Virginia Johnson, these are famous researchers on sexual issues in the United States. They've written a book, The Human Sexuality. Not only them, but even the FBI reports, when they conduct surveys on the prevalence of crime, they say 90%, the majority of the cases of rape are not reported. They occur. People suffer, but they don't report. We'll come to that. Other surveys which have been conducted, they indicate that the incidence of rape is between 14 to 27%. Mary Koss, in her report on rape, the incidence and the prevalence of sexual aggression, in the campuses in the United States. She says, the chances of a woman to become a victim of rape in her lifetime is between 14 to 27%. That means 1 in 7 women to 1 in 4 women can be assaulted sexually. First of all. Secondly, and this is the more disturbing fact, the majority of the rapists are not strangers. They are acquaintances, friends, co-workers, neighbors, relatives. Thirdly, the problem is even more severe in the sense that 4 out of 5 cases are done by acquaintances, and the difficulty is in the reporting. You see, why would a woman want to report? Number one, her body has been battered. Her body has been subjugated to violence. She's ashamed of what's happened to her. She wants to hide it, number one. Number two, even if she were to display and declare what has happened to her, she will attract unwanted public attention to her. And she knows, in fact she fears, maybe the rapist will come back and retaliate. And thirdly, not only is there the fear of retaliation, but the problem is she knows she cannot get permanent police protection for herself. So she suffers silently. And the majority of the cases are hidden. In a survey that was conducted amongst 3,000 students, sorry, 7,000 students in 32 colleges in the United States, the results of that report indicate that 27% of the female respondents say they were victims of rape. 27%. That's almost 1 in 4 people. Not only that, of these, 12%, they said they were victims of attempted rape. 14% said they were victims of actual rape. In fact, 8% of the male respondents said they had tried rape. And the tragedy is, 27% of these women, they did not even consider these as rape. You see, the problem is the context in which it takes place is that you go out with a friend, you go out with a neighbor, you go out with a relative, and a situation comes about when suddenly this person becomes aggressive from a point of view that this woman never expected. She never expected. And that's why there is that sense of guilt, there's this sense of shame. In fact, there's great sense of rage and anger and betrayal. And those psychologists who study the results of rape on these victims, they found there are 3 stages. Stage number 1, there is the emotional trauma. Stage number 2, there is denial. And stage number 3, there is resolution. I want to share with you these problems that these women face, but never tell us, and the reasons why they fall into this trap. Emotional trauma. They start being afraid of being alone. They start being afraid of going out with men. They start learning not to trust acquaintances in dates. They have feelings of shame and guilt and depression and helplessness and isolation. So that's the emotional trauma. Secondly, the stage of denial. She doesn't want to remember because when she goes through the details, it's painful. She doesn't talk about it. She tries to deny it. But she cannot ignore it altogether because somewhere in her mind, those emotions are still there. Painful emotions. Powerful emotions that just don't want to go away. The third stage is the stage of resolution. And this may take place months or years after the actual event. That's the time when if she finds someone who's understanding of her, who is supportive of her, maybe a friend, maybe a counselor, maybe a member of the clergy, when she resolves her fears and comes to settle down with her feelings, that's when she can carry on with her life normally. Nevertheless, even those people who have reached the state of resolution, some of these females are yet haunted by those memories. A fourth effect and consequence on the lives of the victims of rape is that if they're in college or in school, they drop out. If they remain in school, their academic performance is affected because of the economic distress they suffer, emotional distress that they suffer. So having realized the incidence and the prevalence of rape, and having realized the consequences, we need to discuss why does it happen. Researchers have said there are two major factors. There are the non-communication factors and there are the communication factors. The non-communication factors is, you see, in the context of a date, in the context of a friendship going out, if they take alcohol or drugs, obviously their inhibitions go down, and therefore the willingness of the male, the readiness of the male partner to use force is higher. Not only that, the willingness of the female partner to become vulnerable to the use of force is also higher. So one is alcohol or drugs. Secondly, is the expectations of the gender roles, the role expectations of what a male or a female is supposed to do in a date setting. When interviewed, more than 50% of males say that after the fifth date, it was appropriate and okay to have sex. Only 23% of those interviewed say that after the fifth date, it was okay to have sex. Look at the attitude. When you're bombarded in society that a person is masculine when he's sexually active, this is the result. The third non-communicating factor, which facilitates the act of rape, is, according to some researchers, the media, with its sexual violent themes, encourages this attitude in the males. When in the laboratory they were exposed to such media, and then their attitudes were checked, the number of males and their readiness to commit rape was higher compared to those who were not exposed to these sexually violent themes in the media. Not only that, look at the famous case of Mike Tyson and the case of William Kennedy Smith, who were caught in the cases of rape within the context of date. They were dating, and then the females went and filed a lawsuit that they were raped within the date. And you get this idea that males have something known as the rape myth. It's called a myth, but actually it's a factual perception. What happens is, these males believe that if a woman is dressed provocatively, that she is inviting sex, first of all. Secondly, if she allows you to touch her, she is inviting sex. Third of all, the fact that she has come out with you, and the fact that she is ready to be petted and necked with, shows her readiness. Not only that, women have an unconscious desire to enjoy sex. Look at these myths. They call it myths, the rape myth, but we know these are actual perceptions of males when they go out for dates, when they have affairs. These are the non-communication factors. Come to the communication factors. Studies have been done, and they indicate that the majority of the males in date rape situations, when they see a friendly behavior from the female, not a sexual behavior, a friendly behavior from the female, they interpret it as sexual request. And that's a misinterpretation, but that's an actual fact. It's happening. Not only that, when they propose sex in their date, and when the female says no, they take it to mean yes. She wants it, but she says no to me. Or when she says no, her actual meaning is, maybe I like it. And the reason she's refusing is maybe because she's afraid of pregnancy, or maybe she's got some moral inhibitions, or maybe because she's got some religious inhibitions. The conclusion I want to draw is, if Islam has encouraged hijab, then the effect on the behavior of the woman, the way she dresses, one, that means she's given a silent message to everyone around. This is who I am. This is how I'm going to behave. I want a distance. I want a clean relationship. One. Two, the manner in which she looks at other people. Three, the manner in which she talks to other people. Four, the manner in which she behaves with other people. Hijab makes a clear statement that sexuality is not for the public domain. It's for the private marital context, period. The public domain, the relationship with other people, is to be a pure, clean relationship. We reject that. We start wearing fanciful scarves, and we start wearing fanciful dresses. All right, it's hijab. According to the Sharia, if you have covered your body, and if I cannot see the woman's skin, that's hijab. And when Marhum Ayatollah Khoi was asked, suppose a woman wants to wear a colored scarf, or she wants to wear a tight-fitting dress, but we can't see her skin, or we can just see her body contours, is that proper hijab? He says it's not haram. It becomes haram when it is sexually provocative. I've showed you the evidence about rape. You tell me a colored scarf and you tell me a tight-fitting dress is not sexually provocative. I tell you, study these reports of rape. And they are silent reports. Psychologists and researchers call it the hidden crime. The crime that's never reported. It happens and it's hushed down. But it's happening. And it's happening because of the miscommunication. It's happening it's because of the way the woman dresses. It's happening it's because of the way the woman looks. The way she talks. The way she behaves. Before I conclude, one more word. We don't want to put the full blame on the women. Part of the blame lies on the men also. Ayah number 59 talks about hijab of the women. Once that hijab is observed, then in the community, the responsibility of the authorities is to make sure now they're not molested. Look at the next ayah, ayah number 60. لَإِنْ لَمْ يَنْتَهِ الْمُنَافِقُونَ وَالَّذِينَ فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ مَرَضٌ وَالْمُرْجِفُونَ فِي الْمَدِينَةِ لَنُغْرِيَنَّكَ بِهِمْ ثُمَّ لَا يُجَاوِرُونَكَ فِيهَا إِلَّا قَلِيلًا. O Prophet, tell these hypocrites and tell these people whose hearts are sick. You recall that ayah which said that the women have to talk seriously and firmly to the strangers, so that those people in whose hearts there is sickness, they don't get attracted. If those people who are hypocrites, and those people whose hearts are sick, and those people who want to cause disturbance in society, if they now do not desist from carrying out these sexually provocative behavior with the females, then O Prophet, we can make you act against them in such a way that you expel them from the community. The next ayah, mal'uneen. They are cursed people. أَيْنَمَا ثُقِفُوا أُخِذُوا وَقُتِّلُوا تَقْتِيلًا. Wherever they are found, they should be apprehended and they should be killed. سُنَّةَ اللَّهِ الَّذِينَ خَلَوْا مِنْ قَبْلُ وَلَنْ تَجِدَ لِسُنَّةِ اللَّهِ تَبْدِيلًا. And this is the law of God in a community, in a society, in a nation. The relationship between the sexes, the male and the female, should be a clean, serious, frank one. No intimacies, no close friendships, no sexuality. Sexuality is entirely for the bedroom and the family life. The two domains of public and private life should be totally separated. And if you don't observe that, then the laws of God are severe. Up to the extent that you expel such people. Up to the extent that you even go and hunt them down and kill them. Of course, that's the authority that lies with the Prophet. And after the Prophet with his successors. After the successors with the mujtahids. And after the mujtahids, some scholars believe that even in a community, if you have people who are adil, the udulul mu'mineen, the just believers, they can also take up authority, of course, with the permission of the mujtahid. Let's pray to Allah to give us tawfiq, to be able to realize the excellence and the virtue of taqwa, and have the proper belief and let it settle down in our hearts so the effects flow in the society, so our relationships become clean in the public domain and our joy is confined in its pristine purity in the private domain. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.